Welcome to the Lob Podcast by These Football Times. I'm Jim Hart, your host. This morning we've got a special guest with us. I'm sitting here with Chris Weir. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jim. How's it going?
Good. Chris is one of our senior writers, of course, who's helped me co-host this show on numerous occasions. Today we've got with us from The New York Times, from Bloomberg News, from Eurosport, from all kinds of places, a guy who's kind of renowned in the world of investigative journalism, I guess you'd say. He's broken a number of stories. He's also the author of Football's Secret Trade, How the Player Transfer Market Was Infiltrated. He wrote this along with Mr. Alex Duff. Would you welcome to the show Mr. Tariq Panja? Good morning, Tariq.
Good evening from London. Great to be with you. That's some intro. Thanks for that.
Yeah. You know, you've got quite a unique background. I know you've done this for a number of years, and you've covered a number of scandals. And like I said, you know, I'm a huge admirer of your writing. You know, you've covered bribery and doping in Russia, and homophobia, and racism, and all these things, and it kind of makes me wonder that, you know, do you live in fear for your life at times? I mean, it seems like a dangerous occupation you have going here.
So far, so good. I mean, I just think football, given its global popularity, it kind of mirrors the world for better or for worse, and, you know, a lot of my time is taken with looking at the underbelly, as it were, the bit some people sometimes don't want you to look at, but I guess things that we should be talking about, whether it be you know, societal issues or economic issues. Football does give you that lens to look at all these things, and you know, it's something I've been doing for a number of years.
And what got you started, you know, in this? What was your first sort of foray into football journalism, I guess? How did you get hooked on it?
You know, I grew up in London, in the UK, and you know, at the time, as it, like most kids at school, was quite obsessed with it. At the same time, had from quite early days had quite an interest in the newspapers, so it was quite a natural marriage, as it were. But like all the other kids, I just thought, I want to write about what's happening on the pitch, you know, go to the games, go to the stadiums. The sort of passion that would drive most kids. But and then as my kind of journalistic career started, I veered towards the news part of it. I spent a brief time at Eurosport, and then I spent the intervening period with the Associated Press here in the UK and some other place doing covering news, and quite hooked on the serious aspects of coverage, as it were, with still, you know, with still keen interest in sports. I thought if we can marry the two and look at the news of sport, that would be an opportunity. And there wasn't that many people doing it at the time. The number's grown, probably as the scandals have grown as well, in recent years. And then I joined Bloomberg in 2008. Which was a great opportunity. You know, this was a financial news organization, which had a at that time quite decent sports team. And when I joined, they did give me that leeway, as it were, to do what you like. And like I said, I was in London, and you've got to understand, in the UK, there's 12 national newspapers covering football. I thought, well, like, why don't we cover it differently? There's no point trying to compete with that. So let's look at this behind the scenes aspect. And at that time, there was quite a lot going on with the Glazer takeover, clubs going bust in the UK, and it was just World Cup bids were coming up as well. The famous 2010 decision that led to Russia and Qatar, etc. So it was quite a stroke of timing and interest. It was a, you know, a perfect time to get stuck into all this.
Yeah, so Tariq, I know that more recently you've focused your reporting on the likes of AC Milan's recent takeover by the Chinese businessman Yong Hong Li. Can you give us a bit more detail on how those sort of investigations went? And I know yourself and your colleagues in the New York Times tried looking into Mr. Li's business dealings in the past, and I think it's fair to say that what you found wasn't exactly open and transparent.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back a little bit. I joined the Times in August, late August, and in June with Bloomberg, I just spent about three weeks in China, trying to get a feel for this football project. I think never before seen in its scale. What was happening in China, and I wanted to try and get an understanding of it, and it is immense, and it felt kind of I wouldn't say out of control, but you just didn't know who everyone had piled in, and with varying motivations. It just felt like this stuff was going and is going really quickly. So there's all these actors, and for those of us in the West, we really hadn't heard of many of these people, or a Chinese football culture or football industry at all. So with company, you know, it's like going from, you know, naught to 60 in like a Ferrari, where they were on bicycles before when it came to football. So that's the kind of context. And with that, all this money of sometimes well known in China. Money was going out to industries in sport, particularly football, and also the entertainment, so cinemas, etc., because the government made it a focus. And that kind of fast money attracts attention as well, doesn't it? And you think, and they were picking up assets that we would be familiar with. So in England, we had most of the West Midlands. The soccer teams there, Birmingham, Aston Villa, etc., Wolves being picked up, and then we had in Italy, Inter Milan was bought by Suning, which is an extremely well-known company, well-resourced company in China with an owner that everybody there is familiar with. So that kind of made sense, and then AC Milan. Was also on the block, but for a fee of close to €1 billion, ended up going for 860 million, which made it the biggest Chinese purchase. So when I joined the Times, my colleagues in China had already kind of started this process and asked if I wanted to get involved. And I was like, absolutely, yes, because I had, reporting experience and quite an interest in this. And what I had said to them is, having covered the sort of football business for the last 10 years, the valuation of AC Milan kind of seemed extraordinarily high for what they were purchasing. Because you have to remember, AC Milan, in terms of bricks and mortar, doesn't own its real estate, doesn't own its stadium. It has a training ground. It has a pretty strong brand, and it has its assets in players who were underperforming and would need to be totally overhauled at a quite an expensive price in order to compete and get to Champions League or whatever, as we've seen. And also, it was losing, hemorrhaging money. I think about 90 to 100 million euros every year, and there wasn't a queue round the block of suitors willing to buy this team. And it took so long. The deal got stretched and delayed and delayed and delayed. The composition of the buyers kept changing as well, where we had one well-known person pulling out, which was a guy called Sonny Wu, who is known to Western banks, etc., and would give them confidence that this is, kind of a serious person. And the way the deal was structured, you had the Chinese paying 100 million increments that were non-refundable, meaning that if the deal collapsed, Mr. Berlusconi could just keep the money and the Chinese walk away without a club and without these hundreds of millions that they deposited. And then at the last, they required a very expensive loan from Vulture Fund, Elliot. So all these things had alarm bells ringing for us. And as colleagues in China, you know, a lot of credit to them from looking at corporate filings and looking at documents and actually some old-fashioned reporting by sort of knocking on doors and showing up at places. It just seemed like we could not stand up a lot of what Mr. Li is supposed to be, i.e. the owner of these two phosphate mines, which, you know, told some of the biggest in China. But what we were able to find is that actually this guy's got a string of problems in his business past, be it litigation or fines from the stock exchange, etc. And then put that together with, hang on, this is AC Milan, the second most successful club team in European football. Is this the guy who's just bought them? Was anybody looking? Was anybody checking? And my kind of conclusion after talking to, you know, bankers and lawyers and other sort of characters involved is no one really wanted to pull the plug on this because there was a lot of money to be made. Mr. Berlusconi wanted a billion. He got 860 million. That's still remarkable. The banks obviously got their fees, and we got two of Italy's biggest law firms on the case. Now, if we've got, like, you know, three reporters from a newspaper being able to find all this stuff, I'm sure the banks must have, if they wanted to, would have found out about this as well.
And given all that, I mean, you know, any Milan fans listening to this probably won't be too reassured, you know, given this man's business past and the difficulty in establishing some basic facts around, you know, his dealings. And should AC Milan fans be worried about the future of their club under his stewardship? Or I know that their business plan was recently turned down by UEFA. I mean, how bad is it looking in the future, in the short-term future anyway?
Well, you know, you just mentioned a very important point. You don't have to look, you know, rely on journalists to give you sort of comfort or discomfort. You've got UEFA's independent financial control body, which is made up of, I believe, quite a professional group of people who are experts in the field, saying they can't give a clean bill of health to this. So if they're concerned, I would be concerned if I was an AC Milan fan. And this is the thing as well. Like, fans always think the grass is going to be greener if someone else comes and buys a club. They're going to do all this stuff. And like, you know, it often isn't the case. What are the scenarios available to AC Milan now? Well, they've got this kind of ticking time bomb of a loan with Elliot, the hedge fund, the owners have, which if they fail to pay at quite an eye-watering exchange interest rate, which is about 11%, they would be in default, and the club will be owned by Elliott, American hedge fund, which has no interest, no business in owning a football club. So that's going to be an issue. Should they find someone else to take on their loan, they're not going to find. I can't imagine someone offering them a great deal under their circumstances. The best case, I think, is someone else either buys a major stake or takes over the club and you get another owner in. Because there hasn't been much in the way of reassurance from the owners. They haven't really said anything, have they? Unless I've missed something. I haven't seen this big plan, this big vision from Mr. Li or any kind of public-facing pronouncements about how and where AC Milan is going to be in the next few years. So yeah, I'd be worried.
I suppose we could probably spend the whole podcast talking about AC Milan, but yeah. I mean, if we could just talk about, you know, the Chinese government's attempts to make inroads into football more generally. I know that you've reported in Document 46, which means that now sport is linked explicitly to China's economic plan. How serious do you think Xi Jinping is about delivering on this goal? And do you think China will succeed, given the long-standing cultural aversion to football as a sort of career choice? And, you know, the established prestige of European clubs, do you think it's feasible?
Depends what success looks like. And it is serious. It is definitely serious. So you've got to look at this in two parts, I think. One part is the kind of piece that has garnered all the publicity, I guess, which is away from these European club acquisitions. If we look at mainland China, the CSL and the growth of the league there, the money spent on luring top talent and coaches over to China to play there. So still, you could see there's been teething problems with that as well, i.e., you know, they've spent in the beginning loads of money, hired these players at you know, some of the highest salaries, if not the highest salaries on the planet. And you know, if you were a guy, you know, Tevez, etc., Hulk, who've gone over there, they've paid huge sums of money. And then, you know, within a year, the rules keep changing about how many under 23 players you can have, how many foreign players you can have, and it seems a little bit idiosyncratic. You know, it can change day to day. So will these clubs be challenging the top clubs in the world, i.e., you know, European clubs? I don't think so, certainly in the short time. The interesting thing is the reason they keep changing the rules is this is primarily about creating a framework that will create Chinese football talent, domestic football talent, to flourish. So, you know, China's lost in the World Cup was 2002, lost all its matches, and this is a bit of a national humiliation. Xi is a football fan, and you know, in China, China celebrates Chinese success more than anything else. They want a successful Chinese national football team, but at the same time, they also want this middle-class population to have pursuits and activities, and football seems to fit the bill. So in terms of scale, I haven't seen anything of this size. There are literally tens of thousands of these academies or soccer schools opening in various states all across China. And that the scale of these, you know, for example, I went to one in Guangzhou, which was a school which is ostensibly run by Guangzhou Evergrande, the team there in partnership with Real Madrid. I must say there's very little input from Real Madrid there, say from sending a few Spanish coaches there. But there were 2,000 to 3,000 children living on this campus, 50 football fields, and they do their schooling around a football curriculum. And that's so, but this is going to take a really, really, really long time. But I think much far bigger than what's happening in the CSL is what's happening at the grassroots level in the sheer kind of numbers we're talking about. You know, that's really impressive. Now, to answer your point, will it succeed? That's really interesting as well, because if you think about China and what they've done in sport, they did build a very successful Olympic program, didn't they? You know, they win a lot of medals, but they win medals in individual sports, not really team sports. China has never, I don't think, excelled in team sports. I think in Rio, it was a huge moment for China where I think the women's volleyball team won gold. That was a big, big moment because that was a team sport success. And what will be interesting is whether Chinese culture and the education system there being what it is, it's ultra competitive education culture there, which is explained by the population. Can that foster a successful and creative football culture? That's going to be a time will tell, but it's a really, really interesting project to follow.
So, back to a little different subject here, Tariq. From your book, what would you say that most people in the footballing world, you know, people who follow football, what do you think they should take from your book as it relates to the transfer market from your book as sort of the most interesting or shocking or biggest revelation about the transfer market?
Maybe not in terms of revelation, just this is how the mechanics works. When you take the emotion out of it, there is so much money that is in the modern football industry, and particularly the transfer market, that the kind of actors who are attracted to this have a different agenda, different motivation than perhaps 95% of people who follow the sport. And they could be trading in football players in the same way they could be trading in other commodities like corn or oil or anything like that. There is no emotion here for these people. And this is where I think the game has to be a bit careful, because, you know, we talked about AC Milan earlier. These are clubs that, all clubs have their fan base, which is so passionate and is so loyal to this team. It's not for them a product for sale, etc. That ship has sailed, obviously. I mean, look, we see this money moving around. But what I found, what Alex and I found quite alarming is the lack of control any regulator has over the market. And in that sense, it'd be FIFA, essentially, or whoever controls the global marketplace, because these people are a lot smarter than anyone who is trying to police it, if they are trying to police the industry. And, you know, like when you have little oversight, you risk corruption, you risk criminality through money laundering, and you risk perhaps that, more importantly, like the well-being and welfare of young people, be it these young athletes.
So, did you find instances where there was, like, individual instances where there was, you know, absolute corruption happening, where there was, you know, money laundering, where these other things were occurring?
We found the conditions for this in the sense of the kind of opaque behavior, the opaque construction of companies, which would be domiciled in several offshore locations, not identifying who their owners are. I mean, for example, the Carlos Tevez and Javier Mascherano story, which is kind of well known, but we dug into that in as much more detail as we could. The owners, we believe, the beneficial owners of the fund that controlled their transfer rights were two Russian oligarchs who are now deceased. Both died in unnatural circumstances, several years after they were transferred, probably nothing to do with the football business itself. But they were not known. The idea that we didn't know that, you know, Badru Patakashvili and Boris Berezovsky were the money behind the movements of Carlos Tevez and Javier Mascherano, first from Argentina to Brazil, then from Brazil to the Premier League. I remember talking to Richard Scudamore, Premier League executive chairman now. He was a CEO of the league at the time, and the English league had rules. That's the thing. It had rules saying, look, we can't have players owned by investors in our league because it risks the competition, i.e. if you can own players in different teams, that could risk the integrity of games, etc. And they were told by the English club who bought these two players at the time, West Ham, yeah, that's all fine. And it turns out that was not the case. Tevez ended up keeping West Ham in the Premier League on the last day with a goal against Manchester United. The three teams that relegated were, crying foul. It led to litigation, etc. You know, if there is no regulation, if the marketplace is so opaque and if people can sort of run rings around the authorities, I think the kind of stability of competition and the teams is going to be in question. And I think that's what we've got to look out for. And FIFA, to the credit, since 2014, 2015, have banned this sort of thing. But as I was saying earlier, the people who are attracted to the big money in football are attracted to the money. And they're not going to sort of let go just because the rules have changed. They've changed their behaviour. And I believe what we're going to see now, what we are seeing, are going to be takeovers of very small teams in jurisdictions like Malta, Cyprus, we've seen Belgium, other places where these guys will park their money and move clubs or move players around through this method because they see it as a great money making venture.
Speaking of Russians, I know you've done a lot of reporting on doping and the International Olympic Committee and this kind of thing. Do you think this doping scandal that's occurring with the Russian Olympics, do you think that's going to spill over into the World Cup at all?
Well, yeah, I think it already has spilled over into the World Cup, in the sense that the Dr. Rodchenkov, the whistleblower, he's alluded to the fact there were footballers on the list. They may or may not include players who played for the Russian national team at the time, where the records are. I think the records run to 2015, so that could include players who played at the last World Cup. And again, there is a process. Well, FIFA says there is a process. Rodchenkov's lawyer, Jim Walden, says FIFA is sort of dragging its heels, walking through treacle, moving so slowly that they won't have to make a decision on this until after the World Cup, because FIFA is in a bind, isn't it? Of all the places in the world to have the World Cup this year, next year, it's Russia, and this is a situation involving Russia. But the thing is, if FIFA doesn't act, the media, as it has been, will continue being on top of them, and that's going to create a very kind of negative atmosphere around the tournament, which is something that we saw firsthand at the draw for the World Cup. Which is the draw is quite an exciting day, isn't it? You see which teams are playing against each other in the opening group. And it's kind of the starting pistol for everyone to get excited about. But I remember 2 hours before the draw, we had the press conference with the then head of the Russian Football Union, Vitaly Mutko, who is also one of Russia's deputy prime ministers and was the sports minister at the time of the doping scandal. He was sat there alongside Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, ostensibly to talk about the World Cup in Russia. And I would say 4/5 of that press conference was overshadowed with questions over Vitaly Mutko and the doping scandal. So you can see it's already seeped into the World Cup.
So kind of as we start to wrap things down here a little bit, there's a scandal, I guess, still within FIFA, still within, the Chuck Blazer story, still with all that stuff going on. How do you think that gets resolved within FIFA? And does FIFA even come out of this thing with any face left?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. The like you said, we had the verdicts earlier this month in the of the three individuals who pleaded not guilty. You had the two convicted, including the head of South American football, and one was not guilty. But the revelations about football culture that came out in that trial might not surprise us now because we're a bit jaded from it. But again, it's stark relief that this was the type of behaviour that was exhibited or allowed to be exhibited and perpetrated by individuals working in football for a really long time. So FIFA would say, well, if you look at the case, we weren't directly involved. This wasn't anything directly to do with FIFA's activities, i.e. These were South American television contracts, etc. But FIFA is the ultimate body that governs football. It showed, and these guys had some of the seats at the highest table. These were the people who were running world football, and FIFA kind of allowed them to behave that way. If you want to look at it like this, they would then say, "Well, look, everyone's been arrested. There's been this purge. We've got new leadership, etc." But what I would say is, what have we seen from this new leadership? There is little kind of evidence that the culture of politics before football and favours and planning for building support from national associations for the next FIFA presidential election supersedes anything to do with football. That culture that was there before seems to have remained in place. If you've sort of moved the deck chairs around a little bit, but the behaviour is the same. You replace Sepp Blatter maybe with Gianni Infantino. But what's Gianni Infantino doing? He's replacing people who may have been loyal to Mr. Blatter, or they've been removed, and trying to create a situation where you have more loyal people to yourself. And to be honest with you, you could argue that that's quite natural because a leader wants to be there. But then that to me speaks to the fact structurally FIFA has not changed. So all of this noise, all of this public disquiet, media disquiet, etc., it kind of is still bouncing off the people who are responsible, because they're still in the same structures, in the same environment they have always been in. So the big reckoning that should have happened, I don't think has happened. And the implications of this is FIFA is still getting negative coverage, and not only from the trials that have taken place and the arrests of people, but from the behaviour exhibited by current FIFA officials. And another kind of effect of this is the absence of sponsors from the West, so from America or Europe. We have not seen a new sponsor, a new one, sign since 2011. That's quite a long way. What we have seen is paymaster sponsors coming from Qatar, from Russia, and from China. And maybe FIFA's reputational risks are such that the companies in those countries don't mind. But it clearly seems to be a problem for companies in countries in the West, and that is quite should be quite humiliating for FIFA, because essentially they own one of the, if not the foremost product in world football, which is the World Cup, which gets more eyeballs than anything else in the world. You know, sponsors would be normally clambering over one another to put their names in something like this. So the problems haven't gone away. I think we'll still see issues arise from time to time. The focus on how they are dealing or not dealing with the Russia doping inquiry is also maybe also speaks to the culture there. I would love to say I'm really confident that FIFA's reformed and is a new body, and you know, we should all look to the future with great confidence. But I'm afraid I can't do that just yet.
Well, keep up the work. It's important work. I find it important anyway. So,
appreciate it, yeah.
I want to thank you for taking some time out of your day to be with us. It was a great conversation. I appreciate it, Tariq.
Enjoyed it very much.
Yeah.
Talk to you both. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thanks, guys. Hope we can do this again.
Yeah, I would love to, Tariq. Thank you very much. This has been Mr. Tariq Panja from the New York Times, primarily, I guess, at this point. Where else can they find you, Tariq?
No, I'm just with the New York Times now.
Okay. And this has been Jim Hart with These Football Times and my associate, Chris Weir. So you can catch us on thesefootballtimes.co. Thank you for listening.